This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're in this evening for what I expect will be quite a substantive and revealing discussion of the interwoven histories of religion and capitalism in America. That's what Chris Layman's new book, The Money Cult, is about. Chris is a journalist. He's currently a senior editor and columnist for The Baffler and writes a column for In These Times. So he's well-versed in cultural trends. He's written a couple of earlier books, but The Money Cult is his most ambitious work yet. It covers the gamut from the Puritan work ethic to modern-day prosperity preachers and their pay-to-pray pitches in mega churches, and it traces the important impact on U.S. society that has resulted from the tendency in American Protestantism to celebrate wealth as a spiritual virtue. For all the tensions that have existed between Protestant piety and the quest for material wealth, Chris persuasively chronicles an often symbiotic relationship between them. He shows that worldly gain and material success have long been a focus of this country's Protestant faith, which has sanctioned the pursuit of wealth and tolerated rather than challenged economic inequality. Religion in America was never really secularized, he writes. Instead, the market was sanctified. It's a provocative thesis and one that should make for an engaging conversation. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Chris Layman.
Thanks, Brad. And thank you all for coming out. Is that better? very gracious introduction from Brad Graham, and I always feel honored to be even as a customer in Politics and Prose. So it's a great, great institution. However, Brad said I was going to rehearse the vast, variegated history of Protestantism and money across, 400 years. That's a lie. It's Washington in 2016, so I'm going to talk about Donald Trump. It's the law. But I want to talk about one specific feature of the Trump phenomenon, which is, as I think anyone who's been cursed with following this election cycle knows, he's performed surprisingly well among evangelical voters. And this seems bizarre. This is a man who has the sort of appearance and speech habits and behavior of a poolside Roman emperor. And he's a former casino mogul, twice divorced. So, as recently as last week, he had this vast convocation of 1,000 evangelical leaders who he got it before and said, I'm a tremendous believer. Because, huge just doesn't quite capture it in this case. And yet, we learn as recently as today in the Washington Post that Trump, who is now plumping this image of himself as this, philanthropic-minded, good works-type Christian believer, has been lying about his charitable donations about a couple hundredfold. He's exaggerated. He claims to have given tremendous amounts of money, millions upon millions, and he's actually donated less than $10,000 over the past 7 years. So, that's the paradox, right? You've got someone who is, trying and succeeding to shore up his popular appeal among the evangelical right, who's, beggaring needy causes and lying about it. This doesn't seem Christian, right? However, from the vantage point of my book, this seeming paradox isn't really a paradox. The idea that the evangelical right has, failed to act in a principled fashion and reject Donald Trump is only a paradox if you haven't been paying attention to what the evangelical right has been up to, I would argue, yes, over the past 400 years, but very recently with regard to the prosperity gospel. Donald Trump was also gave an account, you know, which always has to be asterisked, of his conversion at the hands of a prosperity preacher in Florida named Paula White. But the more important figure, I would argue, in this phenomenon, the convergence of the money faith and the political money faith, is Joel Osteen, who is a figure who bookends the story I tell in The Money Cult, actually. And he's an old friend of Trump's. In fact, when Osteen debuted his SiriusXM radio show, Donald Trump was the first on-air guest a couple years ago. The two men also share a lot of biographical traits in common, but I'm going to skip over that. I have an op-ed in the Washington Post about all that, so I don't want any spoilers getting out. But who is Joel Osteen? In many ways, I would argue Osteen is a 21st century Horatio Alger figure, propagating a new American success myth. He offers a running conversion narrative that dramatizes just how American Protestantism's old social contract has been discarded in favor of an intensely individualist, success-driven one. Both before and after the 2008 crash, Osteen remains the nation's most popular, beloved, and successful pulpit orator. Like most preachers of today's prosperity gospel, Osteen comes out of the Word of Faith brand of Pentecostalism. It's a vision of salvation that's steeped in a high capitalist vision of material reward and individual transcendence. Word of Faith preachers teach that the words, hence Word of Faith, that individual believers think and speak actually had the power to shape their personal destinies. And in this vein, Osteen's phenomenally successful career consists largely of tailoring snatches of scripture and tales of personal adversity overcome and challenges met in the workplace and family, and turning them into little parables of upwardly striving self-help. A favorite homily that runs throughout a lot of his preaching and writing concerns the Osteen family's own rise out of hardscrabble Southern poverty and the determination, particularly of his father, John Osteen, who founded the Lakewood congregation that Joel now presides over in Houston, to forsake his roots and baptize himself in the fundaments of spiritualized success. Osteen recounts his dad's spiritual ascent in his breakout 2004 best-selling book, Your Best Life Now. And here I'm going to do my Joel Osteen impersonation, which I've been working on in a series of radio interviews. Apologies in advance to any Southerners who are in the crowd tonight. In the natural, my dad had no future, no hope. But God is not limited by environment, family background, or present circumstances. My dad didn't get stuck in the rut of defeat and mediocrity. He refused to limit God. He believed that God had more in store for him. And because he stayed focused on that dream and was willing to step out in faith, because he was willing to go beyond the barriers of the past, he broke the curse of poverty for our family. Now, this kind of talk strikes a familiar chord of recognition for a lot of believers. You have, first of all, the idea that you can't put limits on God, or a God for whom all things are possible, as it's said in Matthew 19:26. You also have this sort of stern rebuke to putting ties of family ahead of your devotion to the Lord. But you should also note in this passage and in many others like them, Osteen groups all of these kind of factors of social determination in our world under the curious heading of the natural, i.e. the merely created obstacles, in this case, to his father's success. And he places God emphatically beyond the reach of all such social determinism. God is not limited by family, environment, or present circumstances. This is also in striking contrast to the God of the Hebrew Bible, where you read, you know, over and over again these kind of elaborate family genealogies that remind you of where the protagonists fall in the biblical lineage of the grand patriarch, the Lord of Israel. So Osteen instead is giving us a God who blithely clears away all the limiting impersonal forces of environment, history, and upbringing, the stuff of the natural. And it stands to reason in this view of things that Osteen's own model patriarch, his dad, exemplified his faith by his steadfast willingness to go beyond the barriers of the past, and that this bold act proved the crucial step in setting him on the path to prosperity. Now, the divine power that's counterposed in this vision of the natural is, of course, the supernatural. And this is where, in Osteen's version of salvation, things get really strange. The fundamental spiritual plight that Osteen describes in his sermons and his books is that of the defeatist soul, who has perversely denied himself or herself the saving vision of a true and divinely sanctioned life of personal abundance. This figure, not surprisingly, closely tracks the principal demographic and psychological profile of the 40,000 Lakewood parishioners in the Houston exurbs. They would be anxious members of the aspiring managerial class who are wrestling with domestic conflicts, professional challenges, and flagging self-esteem. Now, the good news that Osteen preaches to this audience is that God is closely tending to their trials and employing the mechanisms of consumer capitalism to engineer their just battery of worldly rewards. To hear Osteen preach or to read his genially confessional self-help books is to encounter in its purest form the American religion of the imperial and materially resplendent self. Across the many homilies and folksy anecdotes that Osteen tells, God's rather monotonously rendered mission is to awaken the laggard ranks of the faithful to their true conquering destinies in the capitalist marketplace. Indeed, a favorite biblical paraphrase and refrain of Osteen's preaching is that all believers are meant to be more than conquerors. Now, again, the story of the Osteen family is central to this vision of salvation. And a central episode in that family history concerns an early phase of his father's preaching career. This was a time right after John Osteen had left his home denomination of Southern Baptism to found the Pentecostal Word of Faith congregation at Lakewood. And he and his family were struggling to get by. This was a time, Joel Osteen writes, when our family barely had enough food to get along. And to help make ends meet, his parents boarded a visiting minister in their house for a week, and a concerned businessman in the Lakewood congregation gave Osteen's dad a check for $1,000, which was a lot of money back in the 1960s. But the elder Osteen was still in the poverty mentality, in the snare of the natural, remember. And so, like any good shepherd in Christ, he turned the windfall over to his church rather than giving it to his family. The moral of the story for both father and son couldn't be plainer. This is Joel again. Daddy later said, "With every step I took as I walked to the front of the church to put that check in the offering, something inside me was saying, don't do it. Receive God's blessings. Receive God's goodness." But he didn't listen. He reluctantly dropped the check into the offering. He later said, "When I did, I felt sick to my stomach." God was trying to increase my dad. He was trying to prosper him. But because Daddy's deeply embedded poverty mentality, he couldn't receive it. God was trying to get him to step up to the banquet table. But because of Dad's limited mindset, he couldn't see himself having an extra $1,000. Or if we want to move this parable back into the rhetorical register of Donald Trump, the message would be something like this. John Osteen couldn't let God lift himself up from loserdom. Sad. But this is, after all, a work of preaching and a conversion narrative, so it has a happy ending. Once John Osteen set aside the pinched and confining precepts of his inherited poverty mindset, God took control, and the Osteen clan was launched into successful preaching and American riches. Here again, though, there are several striking themes that are worth marking in this folksy yarn. it is, most strikingly for me at least, a seamless leap for Osteen and other preachers of the prosperity gospel to discern the divine will in a windfall of cash. Though none of these preachers are theologically driven to reckon with the implicit corollary here, that if God is lavishing rewards on the faithful, he must be punishing the less fortunate by virtue of his own refusal to prosper them. Now, the curious thing about Osteen's conception of human agency in this weird moral economy is that for all the attention that God is supposed to be lavishing on mundane financial and commercial transactions, God is almost entirely blameless for hard times. Economic fortune, in this crudely oversimplified version of things, is a pure function of rousing believers to accept the supernatural gifts of grace, a bona fide awakening into the unconditional, abundant realm of what earlier prophets of the Protestant money faith called the higher self. Then, too, there's the unquestioned image of God seeking to elicit gratitude and reverence through a gift of money. It's a weird, you know, cash transaction. It's an invitation, in Osteen's words, to a banquet table that's perversely, again, shunted away by the poverty mentality. For all the historic forces that have bound together Protestant faith and American capitalism, few preachers of the success gospel have actually been so bold as to cite the random fortunes allotted by our money culture as an ironclad expression of the divine will. Osteen's family parable, like most of his other inspirational preaching, is crafted to refute the claim that God works in mysterious ways. In this version of the divine human encounter, God moves in the ways clearly delineated by the market. The only mystery is why depressive or dull-witted captives of the poverty mentality are so slow to grasp God's self-evident ambitions for their worldly success. And again, it takes no great imaginative leap here to see how this view of the world connects up with Donald Trump's. In each success gospel, underperforming economic actors have fallen conspicuously short of the glory. They've succumbed to the defeatist mindset of the natural. Or if you prefer, there are sad and broken losers, equal parts resentful and self-undermining. Sad. Now, because so much is riding on the attitudes of the Joel Osteen model believer, that believer's appearance and behavior are to be closely micromanaged. This is another strong affinity, I would argue, with Donald Trump, as anyone who's watched The Apprentice can readily attest. That is an epic of micromanagement. But Osteen, keenly attuned to the everyday anxieties and thwarted ambitions of his flock, takes pains to spell out in surprising detail just how the divine will should guide you in, say, keeping the interior of your car clean. As he exhorts readers to start making more excellent choices in every area of life, even the mundane, Osteen complains at length about the spiritual toll involved in driving a car that looks on the inside like a storm hit it. I don't like driving a car like that. Not only does it represent God poorly, but it makes me feel unkempt, undisciplined, sloppy, and less than my best. Many times before I leave the house, I'll take a couple of minutes to clean out the car. Not because I want to impress my friends, but because I feel better driving a clean car. You need to take pride in what God has given you. That's right. Joel Osteen believes that God, a force even more powerful than Oprah Winfrey, has selected your car. So this same strange mysticism of small things applies as well to Joel Osteen's vision of wardrobe upkeep. You are made in the image of Almighty God, and how you present yourself in your personal appearance is not only a reflection of how you feel about yourself, it is a direct reflection of God. Again, I've fallen short of the glory. He also reminds his Lakewood following that they must always stand up straight and greet the world with a broad smile. And you certainly shouldn't, if you aspire to represent God as a, quote, person of excellence, lazily toss a discarded grocery store item on a random shelf, nor should you leave the lights on or an air conditioner running in a hotel room that you've just checked out of. Nor especially should model followers of Christ be obdurate, lazy, or inefficient workers. In yet another parable of the divinely ordered economy, Osteen describes the spiritual awakening of one company manager in the Lakewood congregation, who found himself blowing off many irksome tasks of his old job as he was preparing to leave for a better paying managerial post at a rival firm. This is how Osteen summarizes this homily. This is the manager speaking to Osteen initially. One day I went to work feeling kind of lazy, given a half-hearted effort. And God spoke to me right down inside. He said, "Son, if you don't continue to honor this company by giving them your best effort, you're not going to excel at that new position." My friend realized who his real boss was. He was not working for the company or his supervisor. He was working unto God, not unto men. God is the one keeping the records. He's the one who will reward you. He's the one who can promote you. Meanwhile, for the office drones expressing discontent with the monotony and alienation of their lower stakes perches in the corporate world, Osteen has considerably harsher advice. Here he blithely takes up the self-improving, solidarity-averse counsels of the self-help movement. "You need to change your attitude. You should be grateful that you even have a job. You need to appreciate and stay excited about the opportunities God has given you. If you work outside your home, don't give your employer a half-hearted effort. Don't dawdle on the telephone, wasting your employer's time and money. If you're digging a ditch, don't spend half the day leaning on your shovel. Do your work with excellence and enthusiasm." Now, it's easy to make sport of these sort of control freak maxims, especially as they're attributed to the author of the universe, who we would hope should be preoccupied with other things than how his followers muster enthusiasm for their day jobs or choose to dress. But Osteen is quite serious, and on one level, why shouldn't he be? His immensely powerful and influential vision of the gospel speaks to the ordinary fears and anxieties of a class of ordinary strivers who feel themselves on the perpetual brink of socioeconomic pariah status. For Osteen's parishioners, viewers, and readers, a smartly turned out appearance or diligently organized workspace might mean the difference between a steady salary and an indefinite plunge into debt, unemployment, and depression. Or in the way that economic and personal misfortunes often intertwine, it might mark the dividing line between a divorce and a marital reconciliation. These are the realms of American society where divine favor is most often is often the most desperately needed and just as desperately felt to be absent. There is, in short, a poignant quality, I'd argue, to Osteen's effort to benedict the workaday routines of family and office park life with ultimate meaning. Osteen's gospel expresses just beneath its surface an anxiety to appease an aggrieved and angry market god. Osteen's rage for personal order scarcely conceals the gnawing suspicion that the workings of the market and the entire system of reward and punishment that they rationalize are deeply impersonal and indeed terrifyingly random. In this scheme of things, the only remedy at hand is the saving knowledge that the believer is actually in possession of a higher self, belonging to the realm beyond that flawed created order and destined for a redemption that far outstrips its present worldly bonds. The market can only be subdued by the more than conquering spirit if the hated limitations and weaknesses of the natural are dispelled once and for all. Now, as I was saying earlier, one key doctrine in the Word of Faith tradition explains the movement's name, the notion that the words believers utter have supernatural power to shape their destinies. If believers let themselves speak words of defeat, despair, or illness, they will typically, so the tradition teaches, succumb to failure, self-doubt, and sickness. And if, on the other hand, they intone words of victory, success, and wealth, they will flourish, conquer, and prosper. "There is a miracle in your mouth," Osteen exhorts. "When times get tough, don't give in to murmuring, disputing, and complaining. Speak to those problems. If you learn how to speak the right words and keep the right attitude, God will turn that situation around." In the Pentecostal tradition, this teaching is called the name it and claim it tradition. And it's one of the only theological terms I've encountered that is completely self-explanatory. And it's also worth noting in this connection that the rhetoric of Donald Trump, again, operates in nearly the same way. The totems of faith in this political gospel are a giant wall around the southern Mexican border or the incantation of American greatness, or the promise of renegotiated trade deals with China and other foreign rivals, or the notion, if you prefer, that Barack Obama may somehow have been responsible for the Orlando massacre, or that Scotland voted for the Brexit when it did exactly the opposite. These central themes of the Trump movement, much like the evangelical support for Trump, have baffled our pundit class, which consistently mistakes them for policy pronouncements. When in reality, they too, I would argue, are name and claimant talismans of faith. It doesn't matter in this sphere of spiritual discourse that Mexico will not, in fact, ever pay for the erection of the Great Southern Border Wall, or that the Great Southern Border Wall will ever be built. What matters is the miracle in Donald Trump's mouth as he calls for his own parishioners to shout out that same wish fulfillment fantasy at his rallies. What matters isn't so much that Trump opposed the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He didn't. But that his followers need him to be the kind of retroactive teller of truth to power who could have. Nor should we hasten to add, lest we become smug liberals, always a risk here, is this particular brand of magical thinking isn't so very exotic or strange when we see it get applied to our broader economic life. Stripped of their religious language, Osteen's name-it and claim-it reveries of overnight fortune are no different in substance from the vast bubble-driven body of policymaking and economic thought that continues to dictate the terms of debate in this country today. When Alan Greenspan said that there could be no such thing as fraud, or that the national housing market was by definition immune from a steep downturn, he was only offering a libertarian variation on Joel Osteen's own confident surmise that God will reward you for everything you do. And in fact, Osteen, another favorite Osteen parable involves he and his wife flipped not one, but two over-leveraged properties in Houston in succession and gave all glory and credit to God. This, it is important to note, happened in 2006, 2 years before the crash. Again, there is, you know, When there is a crash, God gets busy on other fronts. likewise, when Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, assured a British financial journalist that his firm was, quote, doing the Lord's work by directing capital into the most productive sectors of the American economy, he was voicing a faith no more substantial in its concrete particulars than the assurances of material victory thundering down from the pulpits of the prosperity gospel. In other words, I would argue that it's a categorical mistake to view either the Trump or Osteen success gospel as somehow fringe or outlier features of the American scene. The rhetoric of the prosperity gospel is increasingly the taken-for-granted ideological orientation of our common world, and most particularly of the policy consensus in this city. That's all. So I'm happy to take questions, but again, speak into your microphones, like this woman here.
That was terrific.
Oh, thank you.
Two questions.
Sure.
First of all, so how did he make his money, Mr. Osteen?
Oh, TV and best-selling books. On the Trinity Broadcasting Network, I think he commands like 7 to 8 million viewers.
Does he urge them to send money to the church?
Oh, yes. In fact, my book opens in the introduction, you know, is a sort of dark time in my own life. The God of prosperity was not smiling on me. And I got a handwritten note with a Houston postmark, and I couldn't figure out, who is this? Yeah, I don't know anyone down there. And it, lo and behold, it was Joel Osteen laying out a series of seed faith investment plans that would prosper me. And this was only because I had covered one of his rallies for a news organization. They got my email or my address somehow. So yeah, it's a very his net worth I think is now north of $40 million, which is a lot for a preacher.
Even though he says his father was doing the wrong thing by giving the money to the church.
Yeah, which I also meant to point out, that's what we just learned about Donald Trump just now, right? He says, I'm this great Christian, great philanthropist. I've given millions of dollars, you know, in base 11 money or something. So, yeah, that it is it's a very common thing. And yeah, the objects of charity sort of vanish in this vision of personal salvation, which is a very troubling thing.
So since nobody else has come by.
There's someone behind
you. Oh, there is. Oh, okay.
But no, if you have something else.
Capitalism and the Protestant Ethic. Max Weber.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time sweating over that essay. So,
is there a connection?
Yes. Weber is talking about the accumulative stage of capitalism. We're well past that. We're in a total consumer society, disaccumulated, to use economic jargon. So the Weber thesis is all about work, and how you sanctify both the product of your labor and your own personal vocation as a divine calling. Now we're in really different territory, where you are rewarded by God, but you know it's more for how you dress or you know how you clean out your car or whatever it is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Hey.
Well, let me thank you.
Oh,
I think
you.
It's quite important. I always have to say, you know, I'm not from the United States. I'm from the Caribbean, grew up in the Netherlands, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I come from a different perspective,
right.
as you may believe.
Yeah.
This leads to a few questions, mm-hmm. right? How do you see what is happening here now with the Olsteins and, even black mm-hmm. preachers who are in
Vermont? Oh, yeah, Creflo Dollar, a lot of the prosperity preachers are
quite
in African America.
Which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of...
the most aptly named prosperity preacher
kind of
out there.
It kind of points to, you know, the politics that we have now.
Yeah, yeah.
With the president, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, we don't want to create too much of problems by going there.
No.
But it is an issue here, right?
Mm-hmm. Olsteen
versus the Pope. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The Pope, which after mm-hmm. the popes that came before him, starts to push in a somewhat different direction.
Yep.
Right?
The social gospel, right?
The social gospel, right?
Right.
With all the backlash that mm-hmm. is happening within the Catholic Church that has mm-hmm. moved tremendously to the right in this.
Yep.
That's the first issue maybe you want to talk about, but also maybe you want to talk some more about the fact that you don't talk too much about it. You haven't had a chance, but there's a backlash, obviously, against Olsteen himself in different sectors of the...
Yeah,
of
now the whole prosperity faith theologically
like right.
is regarded with great
suspicion.
Right.
The next thing is more internationally, because I'm from the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
the issue of the pushing out of the United States into former, dominantly Catholic countries, right?
Oh, yeah.
All of this Protestant, Anglo-Saxon mm-hmm. Ways of seeing the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a backlash against liberation theology.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Maybe you want to talk about that and
yeah,
and
my favorite.
How you see that happening and how you see that struggle going on. Thank you.
My favorite example of the last thing you mentioned, the push of a sort of imperial Protestant mindset is Rick Warren, who's another, he gave the devotional at Obama's first inauguration, and he's more politically centrist than a lot of these figures. Still very anti-gay marriage and a piece of work in a lot of ways. But he adopted the country of Rwanda as the first purpose-driven country. His best-selling breakout book was called The Purpose-Driven Life, which is a follow-up to The Purpose-Driven Church. This is a man who knows his brand. It's a disturbing experiment in many ways. In part, you know, there's a lot of genuine philanthropy here, as is not the case with Donald Trump. And he has done a lot to support healthcare and education in Rwanda, which was, of course, coming out of a devastating genocide in the 90s. But, you know, he also preaches against homosexuality. And you saw the same thing in George Bush's had a big anti-AIDS initiative in Africa where it was mandated by law that everyone preach abstinence. There are a lot of troubling features to the idea. And the prosperity gospel actually is very successful in foreign settings. They do a lot of missionizing, especially in Africa. And it's a strange, weird thing to behold, which also, I guess, opens up. You mentioned earlier the question of race and how, and it's a very interesting story because the prosperity gospel comes out of Pentecostalism, which was originally in the Southwest and the West Coast, a revival movement among very poor, heavily African-American rural and urban populations. So the big revival in Pentecostalism was in 1903 in L.A. called the Azusa Street Revival, which is in South Central L.A., heavily black phenomenon. And it was originally, there were a lot of good works attached to Pentecostalism. Sister Amy McPherson, who is a enormously influential and crazy Pentecostalist from the 20s, took in unwed mothers, preached to racially integrated congregations, which was a big deal in L.A. at the time. But this is the faith tradition that over time becomes Joel Osteen and Creflo Dollar. And how that happens is a really, to me, fascinating American story involving belief, end times beliefs, involving the quest to revive the primitive church in the New World, which makes absolutely no historical or theological sense, but is an incredibly powerful drive among all these Protestant money faiths. And this, I would argue, as I sort of have here, that the prosperity, Joel Osteen is a logical endpoint of that process. And why it appeals to African-American communities or poor communities, I think is in part what I was getting at in this talk. It's an aspirational vision. It's the idea that you're struggling now, but you believe in yourself and you embrace the bounty that God has to offer and you will prosper. I'm not going to touch Catholicism, though. I argue with my mother about that all the time. Brian,
hey,
good to
doing?
See you.
Good to see you, Chris.
Been a while.
I guess my question goes more toward the creative process.
Right.
I'm just sitting there listening to you and then flipping through the book. What event or what thing occurred or what several things occurred where you couldn't let go of this topic?
Yeah.
And that's what I want to get to.
Well, it was when my daddy switched from the... No. That's a really good question. I've always been interested in religion. I was raised in a completely secular liberal background, have never belonged to any faith tradition, but have always been surrounded by people who do and who are very fervent and have their faith imbued. You know, my sister until very recently was a diehard Pentecostalist who belonged to the same church that Sarah Palin belonged to. And so you have a lot of interesting conversations. And I also think, like, to understand anything about America, you have to understand religion. This is such a deeply religious, you know, it goes beyond all the crap you learn in civics class about the Puritans fleeing the Church of England. You know, the people who settled this country were possessed of a real divine madness, and I don't mean that in a good way. And you see a lot of themes that we sort of encounter in mainstream non-religious histories and political settings emerge in this really interesting unresolved germ in religious history. And like, it's a sort of, to answer your question about the creative process, like anytime I write a book, it's like I sit down trying to solve a problem in my head that hasn't been solved adequately anywhere else. It's like a disagreeable chore in many ways, but it's also like you do come at an answer and it's gratifying, and then you can move on once you do all the book promotion. But Oh, hi.
Is there any connection in this magical thinking with militarism, this patriotism that believes in sort of a chosenness? And
manifest destiny is a deeply Protestant
and
idea.
And so the idea that current military adventures are really tied to some God-given right, and is it tied to success militarily? You think of Dallas Theological Seminary, which is a very, very cult-like place, but they use a lot of triumphalism and chosenness.
Yeah, actually, I'm trying. There was a General Boykin in the Bush Pentagon who gave a straightforward defense of the Iraq War as a, you know, apocalyptic battle with Satan. It's you know, and these. I think he's still. I mean, you know, he's not as prominent, but you know, he's still an influential figure in the defense world, and it is. I wouldn't say, you know, there's a lot of realpolitik that is anything but religious in this world, but there definitely the idea of America as a chosen nation, as an innocent, too. I was just reading a book by a good friend of mine over the weekend. It has the line, I forget from who, but like, the world can't afford much more American innocence. And that's certainly true. And religion and theology absolutely inform that view of things, in my view. I think it explains everything from, you know, the conquest of the frontier, the genocide of the Native Americans, to, you know, the invasion of Iraq. Thank you.
How about talking a little bit about the end of your subtitle, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream? Would you talk about the unmaking of the American Dream?
I don't. Actually, my agent presented that subtitle to me as a fait accompli, and I was like, okay. I've gotten also, you know, flack for people who say in Christianity where I don't discuss Catholicism. I think it is the unmaking of the American dream in the sense, you know, that, as I was saying earlier, we've moved away from, you know, and also flawed sort of, you know, Puritan's vision of sanctification of work to a kind of vision of divinely sanctioned plenty and no. I would say the reason the unmaking of the American dream makes sense here, even though it wasn't my chosen words, is that, you know, we have lost sight of a social gospel. And that's a very serious thing. If you look at the, which I don't spend much time doing in this book, the positive side of the American historical story, you have things like the suffrage movement. You have things like abolitionism. You have things like the civil rights movement, which was not thinkable without a very powerful social gospel or liberation theology. And it is very striking. You know, it's one, to go back to Brian's question earlier, one of the things that really gnawed at me when I was thinking about this book is after the 2008 crash, religious leaders, to an amazing degree, had nothing to say. That continued as well over the healthcare debate where, you know, this is whatever you think of the finer points of the ACA's, you know, market mechanism. It embodies sort of a Christian mandate to care for the sick, to make sure that healthcare is a social good freely available to everyone. No preacher in their prosperity gospel had anything to say about good, certainly nothing good, and usually something bad. And that's a weird thing, right? If you take what these people say about their beliefs at their word, shouldn't you care? That's a little broad, but you get the idea. Dave?
Does Osteen ever address the grotesque contradiction between his position and the numerous biblical injunctions?
That is interesting.
Rich man, yeah. Camel.
Yeah, rich man and camel, give away all you own if you are to follow me.
Yeah. I mean, did he just ignore it, or is he never challenged?
Basically. And it's interesting, even that snatch of from the Apostle Paul that I quoted in the talk about true believers should be more than conquerors. If you look up the actual epistle where Paul says that, he is urging believers on to martyrdom. He is saying, you know, yeah, you can die. You can be thrown into the lion's den because spiritually we are more than conquerors. That is not a sentiment of capitalist uplift. And yet that's what Joel Osteen does. He'll take, you know, sort of resonant snatches of scripture, transport them to the habitat of the capitalist marketplace and say, look, it's what God wants. And it works. So, yes.
I hope you were really delighted last week when George Will was talking about Bruce Barton during the 1940s.
The man nobody knows.
A lot of this stuff has moved away from what Barton was talking about, like imitating Christ,
right,
towards self help. Can you
order
a little bit more of that and talk about Barton?
Buy the book. Speaking of capitalism, that's a very good question. And in fact, Bruce Barton, I was just about to do that. For people who don't know, Bruce Barton was a 20s advertising executive who wrote a book called The Man Nobody Knows, in which he basically depicts Christ as a 20th century businessman who is a gracious host. He's very athletic and muscular. He organizes big projects that take over the world. You know, it is... and it's, if you go to graduate school in American history or American studies, it's The Man Nobody Knows is like a punchline. It is like, oh, look at how, you know, crazy consumer culture got in the 1920s. They even thought Jesus was a businessman, which is true and fair enough. But Bruce Barton also, interestingly, was a, these words sound really strange in contemporary debate, but he was a truly left-wing Republican, and at one time was considering running for Congress on the Socialist Party ticket. So he had a social gospel, and he took it pretty seriously. And you're right, the idea, that was what it sprang out of, the idea that, you know, Jesus is this, you know, heroic, world-conquering figure, but to be like him, we sort of do have to care for poor people. So that at that point, even though, you know, he is a punchline in a lot of contexts, I think Bruce Barton was still in touch with this social gospel tradition, which, you know, has here and there found footholds in modern America, but right now is very few places I can see. Thanks.
I was wondering if there's a parallel thing that's been on for a while too, this whole abundance idea, mm-hmm, that the universe, there's plenty for everybody.
Right.
This seems to be, in a way, more so, not so much that there isn't enough for everybody, but only certain people kind of deserve it.
Right. Like. Yeah, both things, I would say. Yeah. Also in the 20s, you had the New Thought movement where they preached a gospel of what was called infinite supply. And there is all this crazy kind of writing about how all you have to do is breathe in money. It's just everywhere, and you just, that's, you know, obviously the 20s were bull market. you don't get that much of that talk after the Great Depression. But yeah, it is, and you do go, and it's very legible, and I try to describe it in the book, from this idea, and the original New Thought, you know, people were, again, they were feminists, very active in the successful movement to get the suffrage for women this time. And they were involved in the Prohibition movement, which is a double-edged sword, but very influential for liberal reform in evangelical circles. So they were, they were doing both things. They were preaching a social, much like Bruce Barton, preaching a social gospel and celebrating American business culture as the perfect reflection of divine bounty. But you're right. I think at some point, I would say Prohibition is a telltale example, right? Because you have a very clear, fervent, this is like the hardest of the hardcore Southern Baptist evangelical stuff. I have to remember I'm in public. So that is all about your behavior and how you have to get good self-discipline, you have to stay sober, you have to practice thrift, you have to do all of these things that will, in fact, reward you in a capitalist scheme of personal ambition. And I think that's where the narrative gets a little crazy. Anyone else? All right. Go forth and prosper.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.